Ani, welcome to Bom Sida, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Ashwasage. The Mother Earth Water Walker stopped at Nipissing First Nation and Bom Sida spoke with Anishinaabe grandmother Josephine Mandaman, who started it all. The second 60-scoop class action suit has been launched in Canada, this time in BC. Amnesty International is calling for a public review of the way police handled protests in Tiendanega Mohawk Territory, and the former Premier of the Northwest Territory, Stephen Kakfwi, discusses the challenges and opportunities for First Nations to conserve and develop the home lands in the boreal forest. All these stories plus great tunes coming your way right after the news. Here's your national Aboriginal news. The Mother Earth Water Walk has been receiving much support throughout North America. This is the seventh such water walk, but the largest. Water was gathered this time from the four directions from the oceans and Lake Superior in the beginning of April. The water walk was initiated by Anishinaabe grandmother Josephine Mandaman and her sister. Mandaman says the focus of the walk is to bring awareness and attention to water. She says it's important for people to develop an appreciation of water.
One of the things that I say to people is you need to go out and know what it's like to be without water. What is it like to be without water? Go and fast for 4 days, 7 days, 10 days, 20 days, you know, and know what it's like to be without water. But not too many people are wanting to do that. But, you know, we have to do that because with our children or grandchildren, we need to help them understand what it's like to be without water, to use it in a good way, to respect it. And I try to tell people to really consciously think about how are they using the water, you know, to look at the water in a different way, to look at the taps, you know, am I using the water in a good way? Am I, you know, when you flush your toilet, does it overrun? You know, you have to really know when to flush your toilet, you know, and the showers that you take, are you showering? You know, there's many ways that people have to be creative in their own way. It's not up to me to tell them how to do it. They have to be, common sense to know what to do and how to answer the question. What are you going to do about it? You know, that's what I tell them. What are you going to do about it? So it's up to them to answer that question.
The walkers from the four directions in the Mother Earth Water Walk will end their journey and meet in Bad River, Wisconsin, June 10th and 11th. The treaty with the Yell First Nation will be endorsed by the BC government despite protests. BCLocalNews.com reports the continued protests surrounding fishing sites in the Fraser Valley that have belonged to the Stolo Nation for thousands of years. Stolo Nation President Joe Hall says his dispute is not with the Yell people, but with the provincial and federal governments. A delegation representing 29 Stolo communities met with the province's Aboriginal Relations Minister Mary Polak earlier this month. Hale adds the Yale are a Stolo band, but when Yale Chief Robert Hope led a delegation to legislature May 18th to celebrate the treaty, he denied any relationship between the Yale band and Stolo communities. Five First Nations in BC are asking the United Nations to intervene on a dam project in the province. The Vancouver Sun reports the communities want their interests protected from the provincially sanctioned development, especially the proposed Site C hydroelectric dam. The nations say they haven't been consulted adequately. They say the treaty they signed with Canada more than 100 years ago was a promise to guarantee rights to hunt, trap, fish, and conduct cultural activities. The groups are also using the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples in their bid to get the UN to help them. The Sun also reports the Peace River region is subject to intensive development in the gas and oil industry as well as hydroelectric. BC Energy Mines Minister, meanwhile, Rich Coleman, maintains the province has a growing need for electricity. Dentists are calling for preventive solutions to baby tooth decay in First Nation communities. The Canadian Pediatric Society and the American Academy of Pediatrics submit a joint paper to the journal Pediatrics. CBC reports both groups are urging immediate attention to the problem of infectious tooth decay in primary teeth in Aboriginal children in both countries. More than 90% of those children have cavities in their baby teeth. The authors also have a list of recommendations, which includes fluoride treatment, oral hygiene education, and recruiting more Aboriginal people into oral health professions. Meanwhile, there's a lack of dental services in Nunavut, and it's costing not only the people, but the government. CBC reports in the last fiscal year, Ottawa spent $2.6 million for travel costs to fly Nunavut dental patients for treatment. The travel costs were on top of $8 million earmarked for actual treatment, which included oral surgery and orthodontic care. And children comprise of more than half of the 1,800 round trips last year. Cree and Quebec and the province have signed an historic deal. The Montreal Gazette reports the deal will give Crees in the province a say in the development of resources in northern Quebec. Both parties say the deal is historic because for the first time in the country's history, First Nations and non-natives will make decisions together. Cree Grand Chief Matthew Kuncombe says the nation-to-nation deal is the beginning of a new era. Kuncombe says it's an end to the politics of exclusion and the beginning of politics of inclusion. One of the first orders of business will have the Cree sit down with municipal leaders under a new governance structure to make decisions on development in the region. First Nation fire evacuees in northern Alberta have returned home to devastation. Many members of communities that were evacuated live off the land. One man told the Edmonton Journal that he had to throw away a freezer full of moose meat and duck and now has nothing to live on over the summer. The fires also devastated the forests surrounding the communities, charring all chances for summer gathering for winter stores. A group of chiefs have accepted a land claim settlement in Ontario. The Barrie Examiner reports it's the largest yet to be offered. The Chippewa Tri-Council has accepted the $307 million agreement. Now, the membership of the communities must vote on whether or not to accept the deal. The offer comes about 175 years after the alleged surrender of the Coldwater Narrows Reserve. First Nations maintain the almost 11,000 acres of land was improperly sold. The settlement agreement also includes a 30-year option to purchase the amount of land lost and designated as a reserve land. The Tri-Council consists of Chippewas of Rama First Nation, Chippewas of Georgina Island, and Beausoleil First Nation. A 60-scoop class action suit has been launched in Vancouver. Sharon Russell filed the suit May 31st on behalf of Aboriginal British Columbians who were apprehended as children by provincial welfare authorities. The class action alleges that between 1962 and 1996, the federal government negligently delegated Indian Child Welfare Services to the province of British Columbia. Jason Murray is a lawyer with Klein Lyons in Vancouver, which is handling the class action suit. He says his client wants acknowledgement and redress.
Sharon is looking for justice, and the other class members, people who are in similar situations, are looking for justice for the wrongs that were done to them. The process of taking Aboriginal children away from their families and communities meant that they were robbed. They were robbed of spirituality, of language, of culture and tradition, and of family. So they're really looking for justice here. They're looking for the federal government, who is responsible to protect Aboriginal children, looking for the federal government to own up to its responsibilities, to apologize, to make amends.
A similar class action was given court approval last year in Ontario. Amnesty International wants a public review of Tiendanega Mohawk protests. The organization released a scathing report this week, slamming the province, OPP, and the federal government over land claim protests in the community. Amnesty International wants the OPP to be held accountable for overreaction to land right protests that happened in eastern Ontario in 2007 and 2008. Over the past 5 years, Tiendanega community members have carried out a series of blockades and occupations in an area known as the Culbertson Tract. Meanwhile, the federal government has acknowledged that the land was wrongfully severed from community lands, and it has refused to correct the answer. Craig Benjamin is with Amnesty International in Canada, and he campaigns for the human rights of Indigenous peoples. He says they will continue to push for a public review.
We're quite determined to keep putting these facts forward. And I think on a whole wide range of levels, I think there's a clear obligation for the OPP to take action and for the province to ensure that that accountability exists. I don't think this is going to go away.
The Amnesty International report comes on the fourth anniversary of the Ipperwash Inquiry recommendations. Assembly of First Nations National Chief Sean Atleo is facing some heat over a conference the AFN has organized. According to APTN, the AFN organized an energy and mining summit for late June, and that has upset Anishinaabe Nation Grand Chief Stan Beardy. Beardy says the AFN overstepped its boundaries in Ontario. Beardy wrote a letter to Atleo's office with his concerns and also that he wasn't consulted since NAN territory covers roughly two-thirds of the province. The letter states that Beardy finds it unacceptable that the national chief would proceed with the summit without NAN consultation. Plus, the majority of new mining and energy development in Ontario will take place in NAN territory, and the conduct of those developments must and will be under the control of the First Nations and NAN. APTN also reports Atleo responded to Beardy in a letter and welcomed NAN to make presentations at the summit, and Atleo also pointed out that the summit was announced twice last year at two different assemblies. Aboriginal Affairs and Northern Development wants to hire a national detective agency to investigate alleged electoral improprieties on First Nations. CBC reports the department issued a tender last week for a national detective service. The department may need 5 to 10 private investigators every year across the country at a cost of $100,000 to $500,000. And that's money the department is prepared to spend. About one-third of 125 First Nation elections are appealed every year. Right now, there are two appeals underway, both on the East Coast. The tender for the detective services closes July 7th. And that's your National Aboriginal News. The Women of Wabanaw with Wildflower Remix. The Mother Earth Water Walk is in its seventh journey, and Anishinaabe grandmother Josephine Mandaman started the wave with her sister in 2003 when they did their first water walk around Lake Superior. Bomsaida caught up with grandmother Mandaman May 27th in Nipissing First Nation.
Journey currently, we are doing the eastern water with the from the Wabanaki land, which is in the Atlantic Ocean. That's our journey right now, but I've been doing other journeys, the south, the east, the west, and the north. Right now I'm just concentrating on the east, to getting it to the center of the lakes, the Great Lakes, which is Lake Superior.
And then what are you going to do there?
We will be putting all the four waters, four ocean waters that have been coming, but converging into the center from the four directions with the salt water. We'll be putting it into the fresh water of Lake Superior.
And why did you begin this journey?
Why? Mm-hmm. Well, this journey is part of other journeys that we've been working with the water. In the beginning was Lake Superior, which is the fresh water, and then out to the ocean. And then we realized that the salt water also has healing potential, healing elements that is required for salt. Salt is healing, so we are. That's the idea of bringing that salt water to the Lake Superior. Not only Lake Superior, but the five Great Lakes, it'll be intermingled with that.
And you said earlier in at Nipissing something very interesting, in that you also went down to the Gulf of Mexico and gathered some of that water there, where there was that oil spill that happened. And what was that like?
Well, as you know, the Gulf water has been almost depleted of its energies by the pollution of the oil that spilled in that ocean area. And not only that, it was not only the water, but it's also the ground underneath the water that's been polluted, deeply polluted, and the fish and everything is dying, or was dying, in that water. And when you look at that water, it looks at you, and it's almost like it's almost embarrassed by what it looks like, and that you really feel bad for it, that it's been so depleted of its original energy by the people that are, you know, damaging everything in the elements. I'm not saying who they are, but, you know, it's not my place to say who they are. They know themselves that they're destroying the earth.
And when I listen to you talk, it also sounds like this is a very spiritual journey.
It is, of course. That's the main thing, is that everything that we do is spiritual. It's not anything it's not material in any way, it's spiritual. It's not about us, it's not about, you know, the water walkers, it's about the water that we carry that is very special, very spiritual. So we have to keep in mind that we always think about the water first when we walk, when we talk to that water. We don't interfere with people's feelings. If they feel bad, you know, it's really up to them to understand that what they're feeling is not good to be around that water, because that water can hear what you're feeling, can hear what you're saying. So we're very, I try to tell people, this is about the water, it's not about us, it's about that water that we took out of that beautiful ocean that we did the send-off ceremony.
The other thing I was hearing you say earlier while you're walking with the water is that you're collecting consciousness. Can you explain that?
Well, collecting consciousness is not easy. It's difficult when you try to explain to people what you're doing. And in doing that, you are like the water. We're trying to collect thoughts with the water. And in collecting thoughts, we are collecting the consciousness of people's minds, that the minds will be one at one time, sometime, maybe. Maybe not this year, but maybe hopefully in 5, 10 years, maybe even 50 years from now, that they will begin to realize, yes, you know, we really have to really work together because if we don't, it's going to be parched land that we're going to be living on, and there'll be no water. And then when there's no water, there's not going to be any life. So people have to really understand that, even though there is that belief that nature takes care of itself. you know, that you never know that everything's gonna be dried up, you know. But we always believe that that when we think about the consciousness of raising that, the main thing that I'm really trying to raise consciousness is the people that are destroying everything, and the powers that be, like the presidents and the prime ministers, they really need to step forward and really protect the water, just like it's a common, like it's like the bears, the polar bears, like the, you know, the fish that are endangered species. The water should be considered as a common human right, that it needs to have life, you know, just like any other animal that's going extinct. And that's, you have to look at it like that. The water is going to be extinct, so we need to protect it, just like the species at risk. Well, one of the things that I say to people is you need to go out and know what it's like to be without water. What is it like to be without water? Go and fast for 4 days, 7 days, 10 days, 20 days, and know what it's like to be without water. But not too many people are wanting to do that. But, you know, we have to do that because with our children or grandchildren, we need to help them understand what it's like to be without water, to use it in a good way, to respect it. And I try to tell people to really consciously think about how are they using the water, you know, to look at the water in a different way, to look at the taps, you know, am I using the water in a good way? Am I, you know, when you flush your toilet, does it, you know, does it overrun? You know, you have to really know when to flush your toilet, you know, and the showers that you take, are you showering? You know, there's many ways that people have to be creative in their own way. It's not up to me to tell them how to do it. They have to be, you know, common sense to know when what to do and how to answer the question. What are you going to do about it? You know, that's what I tell them. What are you going to do about it? So it's up to them to answer that question.
And that's a great question. So I've been following the Water Walk online and also on Facebook, and a lot of people are really supportive of Facebook or the Water Walk on Facebook. And I have friends, you know, on the East Coast and in the States, and everyone. So every time people are going through, they're announcing it. You know, they're coming through. We need donations, or you know, stuff like that. And so, how have you felt about the support on your journey and people's reception?
Well, you know, I've not experienced anything negative this time around. Because it's been very, very, people just coming to us and really, really giving us, you know, thumbs up and honking their horns, and people, you know, wanting to know what's going on. People pop in on us through their cars, and they stop us on the road to know what's going on. So we have brochures, we have little informations to give away for them to really know what they're doing. And they're saying that we're doing a good thing, that they really need to. They need to understand. People need to understand how they protect their waters, and also we try to tell them to speak to the powers that be, which is their MPPs, you know, House of Commons, to go and talk to the people there, the powers that are able to put policies in place to protect the water. You know, it has to be done somehow, some way, and the grassroots people are the strongest people, the voices. Voices and numbers are very strong, and I hope to tell the prime minister and the presidents that, you know, little voices can be very strong in impacting a lot of voices, because we can topple the whole process if we really wanted to.
I think so, because there's more of us down here than there are up there.
You just turn it over, turn that pyramid over, and then you can really do a lot of damage.
And one of the other things I want to know is if are you going to continue this next year and the year after, or are you hoping that others will pick that up?
Well, I'm as we speak, I know there are people who are doing their own water walks, which is something that I really appreciate them doing, protecting their own waters, adopting their own lakes, and doing what they need to do in their own areas. So that is my hope, that when this is over, that I can just hear people doing what they're doing in their own communities, which I don't have to anymore.
And one of the other things I heard you say earlier is that we must give our Anishinaabe names or indigenous names to the lakes and rivers again.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and when I say that, you know, water can hear. Water is alive. It can hear you. It's the same with us as human beings. We have our Indian names, and the waters too have their own Indian names, and which is just been taken away from them. And like anything else, everything is taken away from us. And water too is taken a lot of their own ownership of themselves. Like Lake Simcoe, that's not the original name of Lake Simcoe. I know the original name of it, but I can't think of it right now. I've got it in writing. It was named after this Lord Simcoe. You know why? You know, it's a beautiful lake. It should go back to its original name, because it has beautiful meaning for it. The same with Lake Superior. That's not the original name of it. It's called Chickamauga-ming, which is, you can see that. You can, when you look at that water on the map, you can see the meaning behind it, the original meaning. So all our lakes and rivers have to start getting back their identity, just the way we are as Anishinaabe people. We're seeking our identity, and I'm trying to tell the Union of Ontario Indians, the waters too have to search their identity so they can know what they're doing. They know which way they're supposed to go. They know what they're supposed to do.
That was Anishinaabe grandmother Josephine Mandaman, and now here's Digging Roots with Bring the Water.
Yes, his flare, all the crops are dry and dead, and some is down above our heads, yes, some is down above our heads, but I will bring water, yes, thank you.
The second 60s scoop class action suit has been launched in Canada. The second one has been launched in the province of BC. Sharon Russell filed the multi-million dollar suit May 31st on behalf of Aboriginal British Columbians who were apprehended as children by provincial welfare authorities. And Jason Murray is a lawyer with Klein Lyons in Vancouver, which is handling the class action suit.
On Monday afternoon, we filed a class action lawsuit in the Supreme Court of British Columbia on behalf of Sharon Russell. Ms. Russell is bringing this claim not only on her own behalf, but on behalf of Aboriginal men and women like her who, as children, were taken from their homes and placed in adoptive or in foster families of non-Aboriginal families.
So in Sharon Russell's case, what's happened to her?
Sharon was taken from her parents at a young age, at age 7, in 1964. She was taken a couple of times and separated from her family and community, placed with non-Aboriginal families. She didn't get back to her family, her Kitsan family, until her late teens. At which point she started the long and difficult process of reintegrating into her community.
And so if she's filing it on behalf of other people in situations like her, so how many others would there be?
Well, Ms. Russell's claim is brought on behalf of Aboriginal children who were taken from their families in British Columbia between 1962 and 1996. We know that this is an era that that's commonly known as the 60s scoop. It went on for decades, and it was the process by which provincial governments took thousands of Aboriginal children away from their families and communities, placing them in non-Aboriginal homes.
What is Sharon looking for out of this class action suit?
Sharon is looking for justice, and the other class members, people who are in similar situations, are looking for justice for the wrongs that were done to them. The process of taking Aboriginal children away from their families and communities meant that they were robbed. They were robbed of spirituality, of language, of culture and tradition, and of family. So they're really looking for justice here. They're looking for the federal government, who is responsible to protect Aboriginal children, looking for the federal government to own up to its responsibilities, to apologize, and to make amends.
Since a similar class action has been launched in Ontario, are you hoping that the same thing will happen in BC and get approval for it?
That's right. The Brown and Comenda lawsuit in Ontario, we understand, has been certified as a class action. And we're hopeful that in British Columbia we're able to do the same thing. The allegations in both lawsuits are very similar to one another. The only major difference being that the Ontario lawsuit is specific to Ontario and Ms. Russell's lawsuit is specific to British Columbia.
So how long do you have to wait before you find out if it gets approved?
Typically, a class action is a long process that takes a number of years. The first step is to go to court, in this case, Supreme Court of British Columbia, and seek approval from a judge to have the case certified or approved as a class action. That step itself, again, the time varies, but we're probably looking at a number of months to a year or a little more before that happens. This is really an opportunity for children, for Aboriginal children, who were taken away by the car and the busload from their families and communities and placed into non-Aboriginal homes to seek justice for what was done to them, to seek compensation from those responsible for taking away their culture and their language and their community from them.
That was Jason Murray, lawyer with Klein Lyons in Vancouver. Amnesty International wants a public review of Tiendanega Mohawk protests. The organization released a scathing report this week, slamming the province, OPP, and the federal government over land claim protests in the community. Craig Benjamin is with Amnesty International in Canada, and he campaigns for the human rights of Indigenous peoples, and he'll tell us about that report.
Amnesty International has been meeting with community members, both people who took part in the land rights protests in a portion of the land called, known as the Culbertson Tract, both with people who took part in the protest and with bystanders and witnesses, Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal, over a period of more than 2 years. And we've been hearing absolutely alarming stories about police response that included both a preparation to use lethal force, the deployment of snipers, deployment of a large number of heavily armed officers against a very small number of activists, a use of a force that was out of proportion to any established threat to public safety, and that there was patterns of miscommunication and aggressive policing that escalated to the point that we had bystanders, in fact, family members of those involved with the protest, being arrested at gunpoint, a situation that could have so easily led to the loss of life. Utterly alarming eyewitness accounts that have since been confirmed by testimony before the court. So we have absolutely clear evidence that, that here at Tyndinaga, there was very close to a repeat of the tragic incident at Ipperwash Provincial Park that led to the death of Dudley George, and led also positively to some very positive reforms in the OPP, to the Ipperwash Inquiry Report. The fact that we're seeing the same pattern repeat itself, we think is a cause for alarm. We think it requires investigation, both of this specific incident, and it confirms the fact that the reforms that were put in place need to be independently assessed to see if they really have taken or not. And we've been extremely disappointed that despite now almost 3 years of us publicly calling for a review and laying more and more evidence before the province and before the Ontario Provincial Police, they seem to have utterly dug in and are offering nothing but bland assurances that everything is okay.
And how did the OPP participate in the report or come into play?
We tried very hard to speak with the OPP, both at the level of wanting to interview individual officers to get their side of the story, also wanting to speak to representatives of the service as a whole to learn more about what they're doing to implement their policies. We were refused at every turn, utterly refused to meet with us. We sought information through countless access to information requests, which was where we got the information that confirmed the scale of the police response. But even there, in trying to access information that the public should have the right to know, they resisted at every step and delayed and fought against the release of information.
And so what were some of the specifics of the witnesses' stories?
Well, I mentioned, for example, the story about the family members. Yesterday when we released the report, Rhonda Kunkel was one of the people who spoke. And Rhonda has a family in which she has children, as she said, that includes an OPP officer, an Ontario Provincial Police officer, includes a daughter who is a court worker and paralegal, and includes a son who is very active in the protest. And when she and her husband, James, went to the site of a protest in April 2008, after hearing a rumor of violence on the site, very concerned and fearful for their son, when they arrived, they found themselves in a situation of chaos, found police pointing assault rifles at them, handguns as well. Both Rhonda and James were arrested. Spent approximately 6 hours in police custody, and then were released without charge because there was no grounds for charging them in the first place. And you can imagine this, any ordinary person off the street, in a situation which you're already fearful for a family member, to suddenly find yourself confronted by a situation of chaos, police apparently not knowing what they're doing, aiming high-powered rifles towards you. What a terrifying experience that would be. And just even that one thing alone, even that one story of Rhonda and James Kunkel's, that alone, we believe, points to a serious problem in the policing, points to a need for investigation. To the best of our knowledge, the Ontario Provincial Police have not conducted even an internal review of these incidents. In fact, one of the things that we did, when I mentioned the access to information request, we requested the use of force reports because police drawing handguns should have been a record of these use of force. As it turned out, police initially told us, well, there were no use of force reports filed because there was no need to, because in fact handguns weren't drawn. We persisted, and they eventually admitted, well, yes, in fact, four officers did acknowledge that they drew handguns. Three of them never did file their use of reports as they're required to, and the one who did, we've lost his report. So you can see just from that alone a significant breakdown in a basic minimum level of accountability that should exist for the police.
That was Craig Benjamin with Amnesty International Canada. Now here's Howard Nepinak with My Guitar Sings the Blues.
I could never be what I wanted to be. I could never never see what I wanted to see. I can never do what I wanted to do. I can never go where I want to go. Just as long as my guitar can sing the blues. I can never get what I wanted to get. I can never bet what I wanted to bet. I can never buy what I wanted to buy. I can never try when I wanted to try. Just as long as my guitar can sing the blues. My boys.
Boreal Forest, but also participate in development activities in the Boreal Forest may seem like a contradiction of sorts. But that's what Stephen Cackley discusses can happen for First Nations whose homelands exist in the Boreal Forest. And that was the topic the former Northwest Territories Premier gave when he spoke at a Canadian Boreal host speaker series in Winnipeg on June 2nd, and I spoke with Stephen on June 1st.
Well, I am presenting tomorrow night to the on the boreal issues facing First Nations and Canadians across this country. And I will be speaking about the perspective of First Nations, where we come from, where we are now, and where we hope to be in the future, and the leadership that we can take and should take on the issue of the environment, wildlife, water, land, and all the things that are so fundamental and important to our way of life.
So what are some of the perspectives as it relates to the Boreal Forest?
Well, as a child, I grew up, and every spring, you could hear the birds and the frogs completely around the house where I grew up, because our houses were built completely surrounded by the forest, the boreal or the bush. And as I grew older, the land was slowly cleared. The swamp was drained, the wetlands, and the trees. But the birds are still there. And the old trails that we used to come and go on our land are now being slowly forgotten, the ancient trails of our ancestors, of our people. And I look at today and I think, you know, how far have we strayed from the original teachings of our people, our elders? And when they say things are sacred, what do they mean? You know, is the Bible sacred? Are the words in the Bible sacred? Then what about something like water? Is water not sacred? And if so, how do we treat it? You know, why is it that all over North America, including the most northerly isolated communities, why are we all drinking bottled water? Water that actually costs more than gasoline. These are issues and concerns that I think all of us face, not only as First Nations, but as Canadians. You know, how far can we go before we can no longer replenish and expect the earth to renew itself? And what do we need to do, and what kind of a perspective do we need to recapture? We are going to have those same birds singing in the morning for our grandchildren and their grandchildren? Or are they going to be silenced forever because of industrialization, because of the oil and gas industry, because of mining, because of our full regard for how we keep our waters and our rivers and our lakes pristine and clean and replenishing?
So how can First Nations begin to conserve the boreal?
Well, all over Canada, I know First Nations have always been reluctant to allow mining and oil and gas to come onto our lands, to allow foreign forces to come and occupy our lands. And we've always been resistant to that. And today we know that, you know, we take a more cooperative approach of saying, of course we welcome Canadians, we welcome other people, but we insist that we have some guidelines for saying, yes, but our rivers will always be kept clean, and our lakes, that our forests will not be all cut down, that our wildlife will be managed. And everywhere in Canada, we're saying, let's manage the land together. Let's have co-management regimes for land use planning. Let's co-manage our wildlife. Let's set up conservation parks in places where we agree they are needed. Let's set up and have plans for how we're going to take care of our lakes, rivers, and our waters. So everywhere that I know of, we're trying to take a cooperative approach to saying, let's agree we need the land, we need the wildlife, we need the water. Now, how are we going to take care of it, and how are we going to work together to do that? And First Nations have been leaders in advancing those concepts, where no longer is it just government and industry in isolation making those decisions, but now it's out in a public domain, and more we are part of the equation. We are part of the decision making.
And what are some ways that First Nations can, keeping in mind conservation, develop in the boreal to have an economic base?
Well, most of our communities now, more and more, our young people want the option to stay in our little communities and our isolated locations. Not all our people want to leave. Many of our people move on to larger communities, different parts of Canada, to the cities for employment, for careers. But those of us that want to stay, that want to be close to home, that want to work in the vicinity of our ancestral homes, want also to have jobs. We want to work in the mining sector. We want to work in the oil and gas sector. And it means our leaders cannot just completely block non-renewable resource initiatives, but actually to meet and say, we want certain conditions in terms of, we want our people to be trained, to be employed. We want a percentage of the contract. We want assurances that we're going to be part of the group that oversees the environmental, monitors the environmental impact and works to reduce the environmental impact and monitor as the mines are set up. And these things can happen. They are happening right now, and they have happened already in places.
That was Stephen Kakwi discussing challenges and opportunities for First Nations living in the boreal forest. You've been listening to Bombsidel with Jennifer Ashwasagay. Bombsida is an Aboriginal news magazine program that includes current affairs, arts and entertainment in a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal artists. Bombsida means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project One. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website at bombsida.com. That's B-A-M-O-S-E-D-A. And thanks for listening to Bombsida.